Part 19, Cork. Chapter 37. Dolores Morisseau is safely on her way out of the wilderness, accompanied by several of the searchers. Cork and Anton Morisseau have headed back toward Fisheye Lake. Deputy Azevedo and the rest of the search party are with them. They reach the place where Cork abandoned the wounded man. He's gone. They spend precious time looking for the trail he should have left. Finally, Azevedo finds a good deal of crushed vegetation in a flat, open area on the other side of the creek. "I heard a chopper," Cork tells him, then says, "We've wasted enough time here. We need to be moving." At Fisheye Lake, it's Anton Morisseau who finds Rainey's small boot print among vegetation a bit north of the cold ash of the fire someone built on the lakeshore. There are two other prints as well, belonging to Malou and the last of the hunters. At first, the trail is easy for Cork and the others with him. The signs are surprisingly clear, as if hiding is no longer an issue. But what's more important to Cork is that they find no blood, not a drop. He holds to the hope that the man Rainey wounded was mistaken or lying when he swore he'd put a bullet in her. "No blood," he thinks to himself over and over, while he and Anton Morisseau and the other searchers struggle to find the trail north of Fisheye Lake. "No blood" has become his mantra. As daylight fails, the signs begin to disappear into the shadow of night. Cork has brought out his flashlight, as have the others. Long, bright fingers poke at the ground and into the underbrush. He wishes he'd brought a light with the option of a red beam, which would allow him to see more easily any prints that had been left. At first, the beams are concentrated on the ground, searching for prints, but as the night deepens, they swing more wildly in a desperate attempt to find signs in the underbrush. Cork tells himself that Rainey is whole and healthy, and her aim is sure. She can take care of herself. But in the back of his mind is a frightened voice, reminding him that only a few years ago, despite a flood of prayers, he lost his first wife, his beloved Jo, to violence. Finally, Deputy George Azevedo says the obvious. "We've lost the trail. It's no use going on tonight. We'll just get more lost." "You're thinking we stop here for the night?" Cork says. They're at the edge of a lake that on the topo map is called Minnow. Like its name, it's small and now reflects a blue-black sky filling with stars. "The search plane will be out first thing in the morning," Azevedo assures him, "and daylight will help us pick up the trail again." Cork shakes his head. "I'm not waiting another night to find Rainey and Henry." "I understand how you feel," Azevedo says, "but this is my call."
"Fine," Cork tells him. "You stop here. I'm going on."
"That's a foolish move, and you know it," Azevedo says. "There's no way you can track them now, not in this dark."
"I've got to try, George."
"Let me check in with the sheriff first," Azevedo insists. "Maybe there's some helpful news." Azevedo makes the call and explains the situation. He hands the sat phone to Cork. "I understand that you're desperate to find them," Dross tells him. "But going on alone is stupid and dangerous, and you know it."
"Henry tells me that if I listen, the woods will speak to me. I'm ready to listen."
"Stay with Azevedo, Cork. I don't want you walking blindly into some disaster because of some nonsense Henry told you."
"I'm going," Cork says.
"Tell her I'm going too," Morisseau says.
Cork delivers the message. When she replies, "Give the phone to Azevedo," Cork can hear the splinters of iron in her voice. Azevedo listens, signs off, and says, "Go on if you think you have to. I have a responsibility for the safety of the others. We'll pick up the trail tomorrow and follow it. I hope we don't lose you too."
He gives Cork a sat phone. Stay in touch.
They are only 15 miles from the reservation, only 15 miles from the safety of Alouette. But they might as well be on the other side of the earth, Cork thinks as he makes his way through the dark. With every breath, his damaged ribs torture him. Morisseau walks beside him. They move slowly, searching the ground for prints, the underbrush for branches broken in the passage of others before them, the woods for any small sign of Rainey and Henry and the damn tracker. Cork's head is telling him this is stupid and dangerous, just as Dross and Azevedo said, but he's trying not to listen to his head. He's trying to shut out all the voices there. He wants desperately to listen to the woods, to hear the spirits that Henry has promised will speak to him. He believes in Henry, and despite the voice of doubt that tries to capture his attention, he believes in the spirits. When he was 10 years old, Cork went into the Boundary Waters with his father and his father's good friend, Sam Wintermoon. They were gone 10 days. It wasn't his first trip into the wilderness, but it was the longest up till then. The more time passed, the less he felt connected to all that he'd left behind. It was as if the woods had always been his home. Cork's father had brought a topo map of the area, but Sam Wintermoon never once referred to it. "How do you know where we're going?" Cork had asked him one night as they sat around the campfire.
"The woods tell me," Sam had replied.
"They talk to you?"
"Sure. They talk to you, too. You're just not listening."
"I don't get it," Cork said.
"Everything here is alive with spirit," Sam told him. "If you're able to quiet all the noise inside your head, what you hear is a chorus of voices."
"You mean like birds and stuff?"
"Birds have a voice, but so do the pine trees and the tamaracks and the moccasin flowers." Cork looked to his father for confirmation. "I'm an Irish kid from Chicago, son. I know concrete and alleyways. Don't ask me about the woods."
Cork had done his best to listen. He believed in the spirits and believed what Sam told him. But although he tried to listen, in the end, he seemed deaf, which was a great disappointment. Now he's trying desperately to blot out all the noise of his thinking, to create a silence he hopes might be filled with the voice of the wilderness guiding him. But it's Morisseau's voice that intrudes.
"I've heard you wore a badge once, true?" "I was sheriff for a while a few years back, deputy before that, Chicago cop before that."
"Why'd you quit, you don't mind me asking?"
"Too hard on my family. I prefer the quiet of making burgers for a living." "Why are you a tribal cop, you don't mind my asking? Doesn't matter that you're Ojibwe, that badge still puts you at odds with lots of your own people."
"I think of it as doing my best to make sure justice has a fair shot in my community."
"Doesn't make you popular, I guess."
"Among a certain element. I know the Iron Lake Reservation doesn't have a tribal police force. Maybe it's time that it did. Could use a man with Ojibwe blood in him and a good deal of law enforcement experience."
"You jockeying for the job?"
Cork asks.
"I was thinking of you."
"Like I said, I prefer flipping burgers." Cork stops dead in his tracks, turns off his flashlight, and whispers, "Kill your light."
In the utter dark that follows, Cork confirms what he thought he'd seen. Among the trees far ahead, a campfire flickers.
"You go right, I'll go left,"
Cork whispers.
"In this dark, it's going to be impossible to approach quietly. I think we should wait for daylight and make our move then."
Who knows what might happen to Rainey and Henry in the meantime?
"It might not be them.
It could just be innocent campers.
Then be careful with that rifle of yours.
You're sure you want to do it this way?
I'm sure.
All right.
Morisseau splits away, and Cork can hear the scrape of brush against his clothing as he goes.
The man's right. Surprise is going to be impossible. But waiting until morning is out of the question.
Cork creeps to the left and begins his own approach to the campfire.
When he's still 30 yards away, a familiar voice calls out, "Who's there?"
Dear God, it's Rainey.
Cork's heart leaps and he wants to shout for joy. Instead, he calls back, "Are you okay, Rainey?"
"I am."
"And Henry?"
"He's here too. We're both fine."
"There's been a man tracking you."
"We know."
"Where is he?"
"Come to the fire and we'll explain."
Despite her assurances, Cork moves cautiously. At last, he steps into the firelight. Henry Malou sits on the far side, his old face illuminated by the flames. Rainey is standing, and as soon as she sees Cork, she runs and throws her arms around him. He's carrying his rifle and pack, and the embrace is awkward. His ribs still hurt like crazy, but the feel of Rainey in his arms is like holding onto heaven.
"I've been tracking you for days," he says, his cheek against her hair. "I thought I was afraid."
"It's all right. I'm fine."
Cork puts her at arm's length, sees the blood that has soaked her sleeve.
"He wasn't lying. He shot you."
"A rock sliver nicked me, that's all,"
she assures him.
"Is he?"
"You didn't kill him," he tells her. "Just a bad leg wound."
"Thank God for that. He's in custody?"
Cork shakes his head.
"I should have killed him, but I didn't.
When I came back with Acevedo and the others, he was gone."
"With that bullet through his leg, he couldn't have gone far."
"I heard a chopper.
I don't know how he managed it, but he may have gotten himself airlifted out. We would have searched for him, but we came for you instead."
"Anton," he calls into the trees.
"It's okay. They're safe."
Morisseau slides from the dark.
His eyes take in the whole of the scene.
"Where's the tracker?"
"Sit by the fire," Henry says. "We need to explain a few things."